The first question is, what is the difference between human beings and demigods? We are also part and parcels of Krishna, and they are also part and parcels of Krishna.
So we're demigods. Because one of the questions is also why the term God, demigod, why is that term used? Why not demi-man or something? Or Superman? And then we're demi-mans. In one sense, in a broad sense, every living entity that has any ability to do anything derives that ability from the same source. So, whatever capacity we have, whatever the capacity the demigod has, theirs may be greater, but the thing that's common, which is what your question was pointing to, is we're deriving our strength from that same source, which is true. The Vedic literature describes there's 33 million demigods, and they have a specific function. They're controlling the affairs of the cosmos. Like this example of the president with the cabinet. So that there's somebody in charge of this department, somebody in charge of that department. So their capacity is greater, and their function is a designated function. Within the Bhagavatam it describes, with the change of Manus, there's a new set of demigods. There's somebody becomes Indra and somebody comes, you know, the host of demigods. The post is there and is occupied by an appointed and designated individual, and Krishna supplies the power to perform that function. So the distinction between the two is we're also controllers of something. We're controllers of our shoelaces and, you know, our clothing and, you know, a certain set of things we're controllers of. And the demigods are much greater controllers. And they're specifically controlling the affairs of the universe. So there's where the distinction is, and that's why the term demigod comes, like, you know, for Ishvara. They're powerful Ishwaras, but they're not Parama Ishvara. The Parama Ishvara doesn't derive a power from any other source. And the demigods derive power from some other source. They're very powerful, but they're deriving their power from Ishvara Parama. So the term demigod implies their controlling capacity. There's God and there's the demigod. Their controlling capacity is very great. Specifically, though, within, and it was discussed in the person or the purport and in your discussion here, it's within the temporary affairs of creation. Like Prabhupada has used this metaphor, they have no more meaning than cosmic bubbles. And then the bubble bursts and the meaning is gone. Whereas as time passes, the controlling capacity is taken away and the person has moved on. But the post is still there. And someone else will occupy the post. Yeah. More?
The other day in Bhakti Riksha, Vibhu Chaitanya Prabhu was saying that we cannot take the position of Mother Yashoda or Mother Devaki because they are already there. They are not demigods, but yes, they are like mother of the Supreme God. Mm-hmm. The demigods are going to vanish when the material world vanishes. Then could we also become one of the demigods in the next material world?
Or this one. They're posts, and one can attain not only the realm, but even the position.
So we can.
Yeah.
Yeah. one aspires. Yes. Yes.
Do they live in the material world or they are in the spiritual?
Material world? Because the concept of demigod is they're controllers of the universal affairs. They're within the cosmos. the position by definition is within the cosmos. So they're within the material world. And likewise, that which they can bestow is within the material world. They can't bestow what is beyond the material world. They can't bestow liberation or one's spiritual identity in the spiritual realm. They don't have the capacity to do that. It's within the material world, yes.
So Arjuna, Mother Yashoda, they're all not demigods, but we cannot become like them.
Even specifically, Mother Yashoda and Devaki, they're in another category. They're not jivas. It's Shakti Tattva. It's their manifestation of the internal potency of the personality of Godhead in that rasa. So one can attain the position of being an associate of Mother Yashoda. But one can't attain the position of Mother Yashoda. She's eternally Mother Yashoda or Mother Devaki. It's the eternal position. The mood of love that they carry, one can take on, or one can develop the same mood and assist her in her service. Particularly, even as described like that of Putana, she achieved that position of one of the maid servants of Mother Yashoda in the spiritual realm by her offering the service of being mother. Krishna accepted that service and gave her that position in the spiritual realm.
Next question.
Yeah.
Having a bigger goal in mind, which is transcendental loving service for Krishna, is it okay to approach the demigods for some temporary satisfaction?
This was your question, no?
Yes.
Okay. Can you? Yes. It's not what Krishna recommends. And there's a reason why Krishna recommends it. He covered it from the previous day's class, in the summary at the very beginning, which is the verse that he read was this, it's at the end of the purport of text 11, akama, sarva kamo va. So there's the sarva kama, all material desires, moksha kama udardi, tivrena bhakti yogena. So supposing someone has material desires, and your point was, I need to take care of those desires before I can start thinking of higher desires. So, what's wrong there? And the answer that he gave is, the explanation of the verse is, that will purify one. One's desires, when approaching Krishna, they'll become purified to the point where those desires will no longer be there. Like Dhruva. He's a classic approaching God with material desire. Sarvakama or Sakam Bhakti. Classic. And what happened at the other end? Nishkam Bhakti. When Lord Vishnu came and said, what would you like? I'm embarrassed. I was wanting this big kingdom. And now I realize I was such a fool. It was like wanting a piece of broken glass from someone who can give anything, everything. I asked for a piece of broken glass. So what happened was, the question you've asked is there anything wrong with approaching the demigods? The approaching the demigods purpose doesn't free one from material desire. Approaching Krishna frees one from material desire. Right. In the end.
Yeah, I guess to your earlier point, sort of what I'm wondering is, I'm convinced that, I'm convinced about not approaching demigods.
Okay.
I guess what I'm trying to understand the nuance of is, like you said, the devotee asked for, what he realized was a broken glass later on, but he started with asking for that, and then he got to the point where he realized, well, this is broken glass.
Yes.
So, as long as, you start somewhere, there has to be a start.
Sure.
It might not be a perfect start.
Sure.
So,
let's say, before you start, there's the acknowledgement, I'm not pure, which means I have desires. That's just an honest statement of where I am.
Right.
Now, I want to approach the Supreme, and I'm not entertaining the idea of approaching demigods. I want to approach the Supreme, but I have these desires. So the encouragement is, then tivra bhakti, approach Krishna with strong devotion. So that there are these two paths that are described in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, pravritti and nivritti. Pravritti is the path of progressive material enjoyment. Is my approaching Krishna so that I'll get handsomely rewarded with nice material desires fulfillment? Or is my desire to approach Krishna nivritti? So it's that, let me finish. The distinction is, the starting point is acknowledgement I have material desire. Now, where do I want to go? Do I want Krishna to fulfill those material desires? And that's my relationship with Krishna. Or do I want Krishna to release me, free me from that baggage, that tendency of having material desires, and simply desire to serve Him, understanding that He'll take care of what my necessities are, because that's also described in Bhagavad Gita. Yoga kshema vahamya, whatever it is that I require, Krishna will take care of. And everything that I have, Krishna will preserve. So what's my business? My business is just to please Krishna. So the Bhagavatam is teaching, and we're discussing this point. That's the higher position. Nivritti, let me progressively move along the path to reach Krishna where my inventory list of what I feel that I require diminishes. And whatever it is that I do require, Krishna will see that I have. I can free my mind from that preoccupation and simply think of how to please Him. The path of nivritti. So that's what's being recommended. Now, we'll go back to the starting point. I recognize I have material desires. But I'd like to walk the path of progressive decreasing that so that my attention can fully go to pleasing Krishna with the trust, whatever it is I require, it'll be taken care of. Like, a child in relation to their parent. In a more mature stage, they don't have to go and beg their mother and father, can you please feed me, and now it's cold out, can you get me a jacket? They'll take care of those things. But if in a more mature stage, I just want to serve you. Tell me what it is that you want, because I want to do something that will please you. So that loving relationship is ideal. In that situation, the parents aren't going to neglect, you're interested in a loving relationship, so now I don't have to feed you. It'll automatically be there, and even more so. So it's the nature of the outcome, even from the start where I have material desire.
So, I think I kind of understand that, so let's say I have my starting point, and I know that's where I want to, I start with the instant gratification material desires, but I know eventually I would want to get to Krishna consciousness. Now the option that we laid out here is, I keep building on it one day at a time, and the hope is that the material desires will get diminished with due course.
That's right.
Or alternately, maybe they'll get fulfilled, and I'll realize that this really is a broken piece of glass because this is not as much fun as being there. So you think one of the two things will happen, and that's why as long as I have my eyes set on the right thing,
well,
the long term.
Take those two options, and our acharyas are trying to give us compelling reasons from scripture that the path of wishing to decrease material involvement is the preferred path. Because the other one is learn the hard way.
Yeah.
So they, by hearing, the student that can hear very carefully the message of the teacher can get the most from the teacher. And the message is that path of being all ramped up and revved up and go get some material desire fulfilled by worshiping Krishna, it can be done. And in the end, you'll learn the hard way that it doesn't bring the satisfaction that you had the anticipation, because it's illusion, actually. So better not to go that path, the hard way path, and go to the path of, by choice, walking the, I'm not there yet because I'm over here, but walk the path of progressively decreasing according to the increments that I can move and maintain and sustain, so I'm not in this pretending position artificially, but moving on the path of strengthening my love for Krishna, which means I don't have to ask him for something. Whatever it is that I require, he'll know and it'll be taken care of. So let me move that path of love, and then I'll get there.
As long as that path does not involve any regret.
Of course. It shouldn't be artificial.
Right. Okay.
But if the nurturing of that love is done, not by force, but by love, that's my experience. I'm experiencing love, and that's far more inviting because it's something that everybody wants. We can, when there's love, the austerity is not a problem because it's just part of the package of love. It's part of, I'm happy to inconvenience myself for this person that I love very much. It's not a problem. Not a problem. It's part of my loving relationship. And that they do something for me, it's not like, now I'm encouraged because they're doing something for me. It's just part of the exchange. It's part of what a loving relationship is.
I think I understand the nuance.
That's the encouragement. But go back to the other side. Supposing somebody doesn't have, the intensity of having a material desire is so strong they can't even think so much about a loving relationship. Okay. Sarvakama. Fine, sarvakama. But tivra bhakti. And what will happen? That material desire will dissolve. Or come down, just like this other example that was given in the sharing part at the beginning.
How about if I want a car, which is a necessity, I need that to go to the temple? The idea is correct.
Okay.
What is that here?
So, two things. One is, what is real renunciation? The wish is, you should not have a desire to have a car. The wish is that whatever it is that you have, whatever it is that I have, let me use it in Krishna's service only, because that's where it came from. Let me use it in Krishna's service. Part of the problem of those who wish to have a car is it's not just to use it in Krishna's service, it's all kinds of things, one of which may be go to the Bhakti Vriksha program. Or, you know, I need a car, you live out here and you need a car just to go get the groceries. So now, what am I going to do with those groceries? What's the consciousness behind going to buy groceries? Is it in service to Krishna or is it sense gratification? With having nothing is not the objective. Having that which, recognizing there's nothing that's mine to renounce, that's what's wanted. And therefore, whatever it is that I have, is to get Krishna's and is to be used in Krishna's service. Let my life be just focused on service to Krishna. It automatically, I mean, part and parcel of that understanding is, a subset of that understanding is, it's not meant for sense gratification, whatever it is that I have. So is there something wrong in desiring to have a car? And the answer is, there's nothing wrong in desire to have whatever is useful in Krishna's service. If there's something that's wrong, it's the entanglement that comes from having something that then doesn't get used in Krishna's service. And that binds, according to Bhagavad Gita, it binds the utilizer of that something to the interaction of karma. I'm trying to be the independent enjoyer of whatever facility exists in creation binds me to birth and death and within the creation and all the suffering that go along with that. And conversely, having a desire to serve Krishna in a particular way and the facilities that come to use those facilities in service to Krishna, that's liberating. The same car, the same object, the same, apparently looks like the same thing. One of the examples given in purport of Bhagavad Gita is that two persons can be in a factory, and one is in material consciousness and the other is in spiritual consciousness. Factory is a good example because they're literally doing the same thing. They're in the assembly line and doing the same thing. And one is in the consciousness of this is for Krishna, and the other is in the consciousness of this is for me. Okay. Any follow up on that?
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Okay. We'll take the same example of the car. Like, I want car to render service for Krishna.
Good.
So should I ask Krishna for the car or should I ask Demigod? Because in the purport it is said...
Oh, you go to Krishna.
In the purport it is said, you get quickly if you...
The benefit is quick when we worship the demigods, whereas...
So the interest is not just to get the car quick. The interest is to serve Krishna. So, if Krishna wants me to have the car quick, then I'll get the car quick. And if Krishna, let me just serve Krishna on Krishna's terms, whatever that means.
Okay, when we talk about Krishna terms, Krishna himself has designated demigods.
Yeah.
So
he's designated a demigods, but you read Bhagavad Gita, and what is Krishna's recommendation in relation to those demigods? Sarvadharmam puridyaja, mame kam sharanam raja. That's his recommendation. They're there, but he's explaining they're there for those who don't want the transcendental or the ultimate solution. They want the quick solution. That my needs are satisfied and that's all. That's what they're there for. And their understanding is also limited of they're coming from this demigod and coming from that demigod when actually it's the worship is meant for me alone. Right in Bhagavad Gita. That's how, so Why does Krishna create that arrangement? There's a universe, and they're taking care of the universe. He's giving them some service. It's his power, they get some service. We don't, and Avarna is just like this worship of Indra at the Govardhan Puja. The rain is necessary, but is Krishna recommending, because the rain is necessary, now you go worship Indra? Because health is necessary, now you go worship the sun? Because education is necessary, go worship... That's not the indication that we find in Bhagavad Gita, although that arrangement is there. Why? For those that don't see the Supreme, they don't have the wish even particularly to see the Supreme, the wish is their various desires being fulfilled. So the arrangement is there for that worship. And Krishna says, I make their faith strong in that worship. Even their faith comes from Krishna. The process of worship comes from Krishna. So how are we, if this is your question, how are we to understand when there's some need, why not just go to the demigod for that need? Because that's Krishna's arrangement. The demigods take care of different needs. The answer is, Krishna's answer is, just worship me, and everything is automatically taken care of. The demigods are pleased thereby, and the necessity is taken care of. But it doesn't aggravate the tendency for sense gratification. It purifies and elevates one's consciousness beyond that level of sense gratification, so that whatever it is that I receive, it's specifically just for serving Krishna. And otherwise, I don't require it. Whatever it is that might be out there, I don't require it. Whatever I need for serving Krishna, that's what I require. And Krishna will supply it. I have that all trust. And if it's not there, then I don't need it. Because I trust. Just like you as a father and your dad goes, Daddy, I want a Game Boy. You don't need a Game Boy. And all the other kids, they have a Game Boy. I want a Game Boy. Can you get me? Daddy. Or something like that. No, you don't need that. Let's do something that will elevate the soul, the consciousness. Let's do that. But Krishna may not give something that we feel that we need. But he knows what we need. Like, you know what you're. There's something that we may have a desire for that don't require. And Krishna is so kind, he won't supply those things that are distractions. But it's not, he's a hard, cruel master. He's a loving master.
So families can just, I want to add, when Krishna is granting, he just thinks before granting whether he is really...
Yes. Yes.
In case of demigods, they might just...
Exactly.
Because we do not know what is good for us.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Here's a little detail on that point. In Nectar of Devotion, which is another... It's a summary study of the principles of following Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, the regulative practices of devotion. There's a list of 64 items, and one of those 64 items is worship of Ganesh. So the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, here's in that list that you in the book you gave us, worship of Ganesh, but you didn't teach us worship of Ganesh. How come? Prabhupada's answer was, that's for very elevated Vaishnavas, for removal of obstacles to achieve loving relation with Krishna. But your position is, if you worship Ganesh, it'll remove the obstacles for fulfilling your material desires. So I haven't taught you that one. But instead, for removing obstacles, there's worship of Lord Nrisimhadeva. Because the obstacles are the impurities within our own heart. So, we're worshipping Lord Nrisimhadeva. After every arti, we worship Lord Nrisimhadeva. If there's any mistake or offense that may have been made in the course of the worship, Lord Nrisimhadeva, please remove that impurity from my heart, from the mistake or offense I may have made in my worship, and overall, please remove from my heart this fruitive tendency altogether, so that the ultimate goal can be achieved, loving shelter of Krishna.
This could be a material example, but to make it more simpler, just thought of asking this. The headmaster of the school, he knows everything, English, science, social, everything. But if we have doubts in English or science or social, we cannot go to the headmaster, right? We have to go to, if you have doubts in science, we have to go to the science teacher.
Well, it depends on the relationship you have with the headmaster. It might be your father. You can go ask him anything. Or it might be the friend of your father, and you can come to his home and you ask him anything. Depends on the relationship.
So we got to build that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may be that that headmaster has designated, because you're such a good student, he's designated a special tutor to help you in all subjects, or to help you in one subject, or whatever it is. There may be someone designated by Krishna, representing him to help you understand Krishna. In fact, that's Krishna's system. Mm-hmm.
If demigods worship Krishna, why don't they tell us when we worship the demigods? Worship Krishna?
Well, in some cases they do. And we, you know, we don't want to hear that. Some cases they do. Like, there's a very nice example of this in the Bhagavatam. At the end of the fourth canto, there are sons of King Prajinibadi, and they're requested by their father to assist him in creating good praja. So he's one of the Prajapatis. And so they agree. They accept some request on behalf of their father, and they're preparing themselves to undergo austerities in Satya Yuga for 10,000 years. And as they're preparing themselves to enter into the sea, to undergo meditation within the sea, from out of the sea comes Lord Shiva and says that you pleased me very much by your good qualities. And so I want to, and it's very rare to see me, so I've decided to give my darshan to you. And I want to give you something more. I want to give you a prayer that while you're engaged in meditation can not only qualify you through austerities to become able to produce good praja, but I want you to realize Lord Vishnu. So I'm going to give you my own prayers. The stotras that I recite, and by reciting them, you'll awaken your love for Vishnu. So there's a case where the demigod was instructing, rather than worship me, worship the Supreme Lord, worship Vishnu. But there's other cases, you know, with lesser elevated demigod, like Lord Indra, he got really upset when it was worship of Krishna instead of worship of Indra. So there are different stages of elevation for the demigods.
Two more questions. Respecting demigods versus worshipping them.
Yeah. They're in the last verse of chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada details this, where yoginam api sarvesham bhadgatenantaratmanam shradhavan bhajate yomam. So Prabhupada explains, bhaj is the root word of bhakti, and the word bhaj is specifically appropriate for the personality of Godhead. And he explains that respect is due to all living beings. Even an ant, a Vaishnava, is to respect all living beings. But worship is specific for the personality of Godhead. And the word bhaj means loving service. Using the senses in service of the master of the senses, it's appropriate for the personality of Godhead. So we respect all living beings. We certainly respect and never disrespect the demigods or any living being, but worship is meant for the personality of Godhead, or particularly bhaj, devotional service unto the personality of Godhead.
Needs to understand Vishnu Tattva and Shiva Tattva. Kept it for last.
Yeah. I would like to see the exact language of, if it's from Padma, because Padma Puran is a Sattvic Purana. And as such, it's the distinction between the personality of Godhead and others who are in the category of a different category. Sattvic Puranas make that distinction very clearly. So, to see an intimate representative of the personality of Godhead, one should see that intimate representative of the personality of Godhead, not separate from, but not the same as either, the personality of Godhead. When you read the Sanskrit of the ten offenses, the one that says to not see the name of Lord Vishnu and the names of the demigods such as Brahma or Shiva to be equal to or independent of the name of Lord Vishnu. If you look carefully at the Sanskrit, you can read it the other way around, where the reading might be, you must see them to be the same. But that's not the intended meaning. The Lord Shiva's position is very complex. It's difficult to understand because it's complex. In Brahma Samhita, the comparison between the position of Lord Shiva and that of Vishnu is the comparison of dahi and milk. Because what is dahi other than a product of milk? It's derived from milk. It's just milk of a certain temperature in contact with a souring agent, tamarind, or some acidic substance. And then it separates the curd and the whey. And once the curd and the whey separate, you can't bring the curd and the whey back together again. There's separate. So the tattva of Lord Shiva is different, as is the tattva of dahi is separate from the tattva of milk, like that. Although one is the product of the other. So, to drill down more deeply on why does it say this in the Padma Purana, it says that in the Padma Purana, I'd have to see what this exact statement is. But that just in principle, since they're derived from the same entity, they're not to be seen as totally separated, but they're not the same entity at the same time. They're different, at least they're not the same tattva. Okay. Anything?
any other instructions for us.
Not to complicate the matters further, but is that, could that be referring to the Sadashiva that is in the...
And that's complicating things further.
Okay.
Further.
I have a quick question based on the discussion on removal of material desire. From my own sharing and my own experience, you were saying that it's better to pray to the Lord to remove the material desire rather than to fulfill it. So, in having a material desire, I'm also attached to the material desire. Is it, what is the role of the devotee in relinquishing the material desire? Is it, I'm not sure how to phrase this, but when I pray to Krishna, please remove this material desire, is it, do I have a role also to play in that?
Sure. And that is, when Krishna starts to remove the material desire, you don't scream. You stay with that prayer.
I may stay with the prayer, but I might not be able to. For example, if I am addicted to eating sweets, then I cannot resist a sweet. I'm praying to Krishna, please remove this desire from me so that I might not be attracted to this, but let me see it in service to you or whatever.
Well, you gave one example. You know, you don't place sweets all around you while you're praying to Krishna. You consciously, you have a role to play. You mean it. You go out every day and buy some sweets and put them in the house.
But I'm not consciously doing it. But there are circumstances plays out in some way that I have to be where sweets are, and then this tendency or this urge comes to go and
get some.
So is it okay to say, this is where I am, you know? And it might, one option would be to run away from that place, but if that's not possible,
then Krishna, please take away the desire. It's a relationship. So, do I really need to be in that situation where there's sweets all around? Where the objects of my attraction are, do I really need to do that? Or is that part of, you know, something that I like to be around, that thing where there's objects of my enjoyment all around? And if it's really need be, then Krishna, please protect me from this desire. And if it's not a need be, let me arrange my life differently as part of what I need to do to get on the other side of this entanglement of the material desire.
In trying to do that, I have experienced that while I'm in the presence of sweets, in this example, even while I'm praying, this urge is so strong that the prayer diminishes. So what am I doing wrong there? Or how?
It's a little difficult to speak about in this abstract way. I think I already answered it, but if one answer that Prabhupada has given in this regard is, if I mean what I say, that is, I'd like to become free from that desire, then, but the urge is so strong, it's consuming me, then something that may need to be done is to regulate that. Like Prabhupada described In the beginning, when I came to America, the young students, they had so many bad habits. So he didn't say, stop smoking cigarettes. He said, smoke one in the morning and one in the evening. Regulate it. And continue to chant, and here's lots of glove jamuns. And gradually your taste will become purified by taking lots of glove jamuns. So you know, or then another level, okay, you have this urge, then it's an urge of the tongue, then when that urge comes, just chant. And it comes again, just chant. And in course of time, by following that instruction, that urge, because it's just a nicotine urge, it's not a really demand of the body, that you have to eat something just to sustain your life. You don't have to smoke a cigarette to sustain your life. So it's a artificial situation that's not even healthy. So do something that gives us to satisfy the tongue requirement, a higher taste, and then the lower taste will subside. So regulate is one approach, but then what your question was, what am I doing wrong if that urge is so dominating that sometimes it just wins me over? Then go to something that he said earlier, let us not be artificial, do something that's something that you can sustain over a period of time, and then incrementally, gradually move to that no desire position. And mean it. Because the first part of the answer that I gave you was, stay with the prayer. Stay with that purpose. As I'm going through the regulation or whatever it is, some incremental ladder-like approach to the solution of becoming free from the desire, that's something that I have to do on my side. Let me strengthen my sadhana while I'm doing this regulation thing. So I can be present while chanting the holy name. And then it'll act. And if I'm like half present, half absent, it's not going to have the same effect. Okay. Yeah, she has something too. Go ahead.
Somewhat related. So, is there any difference, rather, what is the difference between Shiva Tattva and Guru Tattva?
What's the difference? They're different tattvas. The function is altogether different. Mm-hmm. The function of Guru is specifically a connecting link between the living entity and the Supreme. It's a service or a function, and Guru Tattva is invested in someone that's on behalf of Krishna performing that function. And a living entity may be the recipient of that empowering capacity. And Shiva Tattva is altogether different. It's an agent, as an agent of the personality of Godhead, who carries the glands of Lord Vishnu and impregnates the Mahatattva to bring creation into being. That's Shiva Tattva. And at the process of, at the time of annihilation, to bring about the destruction of the universe. So function is different than Guru Tattva, it's a Shiva Tattva function. And it's distinct from a post of demigod. It's not. One can attain the post of Indra. One cannot attain Shiva Tattva. It's, that's, you know, he's a category unto himself, and is not a post. Last question, yeah.
The other day, me and my friend were having a little argument about demigods and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was telling him that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he was just saying, how can you prove that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? I would say Lord Shiva is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because Lord Shiva has a family, and his family is worshipped. Like Lord Shiva, Lord Parvati, Murga, Ganesh, we worship them, and they are all like, you know, gods, and they're all divine. But Lord Krishna, he has temple, but his wife, we say Radha, okay, but then there's no temple for Radha, and then we don't, most of them don't even know the names of Lord Krishna's children. So if he is the Supreme Personality of God, I don't know, it could be stupid, but then just, I couldn't argue with him, I didn't have anything to say, so.
By what I just heard, the distinction is knowing the family members of somebody makes them. So I know you, and I know some of your family members' names. That means you're also God, right?
No. But the point is, he says only Lord Shiva has a family, like a divine family.
Krishna has
none
a
of
divine.
The other gods have families.
That's not so. That's not so. Krishna had 16,108 wives. And each of the wives had 10 sons, and each of the 10 sons had 10 sons.
But why aren't they popular? Nobody even knows about them.
Well, you know, because they're demigod worshippers. They're just, you know, like Lord Shiva's family members.
Bigger question, how to go about, is there another angle we can look to convince them?
Yeah. So, I mean, what do I tell him to...
Let's read Krishna book together. I'll teach you all about Krishna's family. It's just because you're not reading the 10th canto of Bhagavatam, you're reading these other literatures. But it's the information is all there. If that's your criterion. Because somebody like, you know, if you give a opposing argument that doesn't address what their concern is, you haven't satisfied them. So go there to that, go right to where they are staying. This is the consideration. People don't know their family names. Let's go to the family names. Let's just start with, you know, let's recite some of the names of Krishna's wives. You've heard of Satyabhama, right? And you've heard of Rukmini, right? And you've heard of Jambavati, right? Let's describe how Jambavati became Krishna's wife. That's a wonderful story, the Shamantaka jewel. Let's go through that. And you read it. Let's sit down and read the Shamantaka jewel. And then the sons of Jambavati, and, you know, and the sons of Rukmini, and, you know, and so on and so on. Just, let's become familiar with it. But because you've read the literature that has this other explanation, and, you know, you can say, you know, I know someone that doesn't know all those names of Shiva's family, but they know all the members of Krishna's family. That's because they were raised in a Vaishnava tradition and practice. And I can say that for myself. I know far more about Krishna's family than I do about Lord Shiva's family. That doesn't make, therefore, Krishna's God, because I know his family names. Vaishnavas are far more familiar with that. That's the reason why the family names are more familiar to you, the tradition in which you were brought up. Let's step back from that autobiography, and let's see what the scripture says. Do you accept Bhagavad Gita? Oh yes, accept Bhagavad Gita. Let's go to Bhagavad Gita and see what was said in Bhagavad Gita about how do we understand who is supreme. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam vivartate. That's described in Bhagavad Gita. And that's iti mat bhava jante mam buddha bhava. That's, you know, so that's a address their concern in a practical way, and then go to say, ask, do you accept the Bhagavad Gita as scripture? And the answer is going to be yes. Okay, then, very good. Let's go to Bhagavad Gita for a scriptural answer to this topic. And then you go to Bhagavad Gita. But before you go to Bhagavad Gita, address their concern. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Soulless Srila Rompa Swami Maharaj ki.
Yeah.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Yeah.